Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, there's nothing like a bit of a gun control debate to polarise opinion. Ask the average member of the public and they'll tell you that gun ownership in the UK is tiny. But did you know that 1.8 million of us have certificates for shotguns and rifles? Then there's the illegal guns. But do we get it right at the moment?
Derek Bird was a licensed firearms holder. He held a shotgun licence since 1995 and a firearms licence for a .22 rifle since 2007. The police have confirmed to me that his licences covered the firearms seized.
Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
So much to fit in and such little time. Strap yourselves in for a roller coaster of pro and anti-gun debate. Later we'll hear from Audio Boo's Dolores William, very own producer of Hear Here, when she went out to the Lee Valley shooting ground in Hartford to give a go to clay shooting. We'll hear also from the Gun Control Network, from Professor Peter Squires from the University of Brighton, and from Nick Doherty, the author of the British Firearms Handbook. With us in studio, guest of the week for Hear Here, is Michael Storey. How are you doing, Michael?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Right, no, more than a pleasure. Now, you are a social policy specialist and firearms owner, shotgun certificate holder, effectively.
That's right.
What does that mean, a social policy guru, I guess?
Well, I'm based at the LSE. I'm a graduate student, and we study policies involving what happens in society and trying to make people happier, basically, trying to make people better off. It's the administration of all of those things that make people a bit better off and a bit happier.
Do guns make people a bit better off in society?
Well, they certainly do, because shooting is a huge sport in Britain. It's a very popular activity. It's a significant contributor to the economy. If you want to measure welfare in terms of the value people place on it, shooting seems to come pretty high.
But it's a very controversial topic. Broadly speaking, we had no regulation in the UK till 1903 with the Pistols Act. In 1920, it then encompassed rifles. Moving forward a long old way into 1968, we really had the first gun control of modern times, which was shotguns and rifles, and even handguns at the time were permitted under different certificates. That was then restricted in 88 following the hideous massacre in Hungerford by Michael Ryan, a certificate holder, it has to be said, and all sorts of reforms introduced in terms of writing to people's doctors, but not always. 96, the awful massacre in Dunblane, which saw handguns prohibited completely except for Crown servants, and very, very, very few exceptions. They virtually don't exist. Skip forward, we've obviously had a couple of very notable incidents with Derek Bird, a firearms and shotgun certificate holder, and Michael Atherton, who shot members of his family dead in Durham. Well, we can't say that it's only an illegal gun problem, can we?
I mean, there have been lots of cases like that, and gradually the trend has been that the law gets reformed in favour of more restrictions every time there's some incident that propels it into the national imagination. I was 12 when the Dunblane massacre occurred, and in fact I took up shooting about a year and a half before then. We were all very shocked by that, and I remember at the time, you know, members of the shooting club being very concerned that we try and portray a more positive image of shooting to kind of balance out the negative press, but it's not always easy to do.
It's not easy to do after a massacre, and this is something that's happened in the States, of course, with Denver, Colorado, in New York. I mean, countless cases, actually. Piers Morgan, an exile from the United Kingdom at the moment, is busily on CNN running a national campaign which saw a petition for his deportation, actually, to restrict fully automatic weapons, very much as we did in 1988. Can anybody ever win a discussion on gun control if they happen to be pro-guns after these atrocities?
Well, I think being pro-guns doesn't necessarily mean that you don't favour any restrictions at all. You know, I've been shooting a long time. I'm captain of the university shooting team. All of us would accept that any type of a completely uncontrolled gun market isn't good for anybody. There do need to be some restrictions.
Well, there are some restrictions in the United States, but not many of them.
That's true. But I think there is a sort of knee-jerk response which says, let's ban more things, let's get more restrictive whenever something happens. But often those things can be a bit unproductive, as we've seen. Yeah, the rate of these shooting sprees hasn't really declined with greater restrictions.
Well, there are lots of areas we need to split off from the sporting shooting, from the illegal gun trade, and we'll do a little bit of that as we progress. Let's have a chat now with Nick Doherty, who is the author of British Firearms Handbook, and he's also a barrister specialising in firearms issues. Nick, hello, sir. How are you?
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Well, very good, but perhaps you can help me with this huge can of worms, which is gun control, because there's a huge constituent say that guns are made to kill people. They're not really made for sport. So why on earth would we risk public safety by having them in our society?
Well, that's a very good question from the public's point of view. And of course, I suppose originally firearms were made as weapons rather than for sporting purposes. But that was some hundreds of years ago now. And there are many, many millions of people around the world who do use firearms for various types of sport, and quite legitimately and quite safely. But if you're thinking about criminal offences, obviously it's usually one thinks of armed robbery, particularly drug-related offences where drug gangs are having turf wars and so on. But of course, that type of crime has to be entirely distinguished from law-abiding people having licences to possess firearms. Never the twain shall meet. You won't be surprised to hear me say that the criminal fraternity don't go and ask the police for a certificate.
Oh, well, I understand that, but look at Derek Bird, look at Michael Atherton, and indeed the Hungerford case, of course, with Michael Ryan. It's not unheard of, is it?
Well, it's not unheard of for licence holders to commit criminal offences, absolutely not. And unfortunately, there have been some terrible tragedies involving people who did have a licence. But that's a very, very small proportion of firearm certificate holders who've ever transgressed the law in any way, let alone seriously.
Why is that? Can you explain what the vetting is currently if someone applies to have a shotgun certificate and a firearm certificate? And perhaps you could explain the difference
between the two. There are a number of tests, which I think it's important to bear in mind. The first is that although you could get a certificate with some minor criminal convictions in your past, you certainly won't get a certificate if you have any offences for violence recorded against you, for example. You won't get a certificate if the police think that you're in a situation where there might be a risk of domestic violence being committed. On top of that, every applicant has to provide the details of their GP. The police are free to check with the GP to see whether there are any...
Yeah, it's not compulsory, is it? Let's just clear that up. It's not compulsory that they will write to the GP. It's only according to Home Office guidelines where there's a genuine doubt about someone's ability to handle the firearm.
I think generally licensing departments are more concerned, if I can put it this way, with the mental stability of the applicant. Mm-hmm. No doubt there are a few cases where they might question whether somebody is physically able to handle a firearm, but I think that's pretty rare.
But is it not fair to say that there should be a compulsory letter to the GP, if nothing else, to inform the GP that there has been an application for a certificate?
I personally wouldn't object to that. In fact, I know from my own experience that in France, each time you're given your shooting licence, and it's annually in France, every time you're given it, it has to be stamped by your GP to confirm that he's still of the view that you're okay to have firearms.
All right, well, can you explain the difference then between a Section 1 firearm certificate and a Section 2 firearm certificate, which is for a shotgun, of course?
Yes, well, there are a number of differences. Obviously, the Section 2, the test for having a shotgun certificate effectively is, as long as you're of good character and not ill and so on, then you're realistically entitled to have one in Britain, as long as you have some reason for wishing to have a shotgun certificate. With a Section 1 firearm, the criteria is a great deal more strict. You have to show a good reason for having each firearm on the certificate, and you have to have firearms granted to you that are appropriate to what you wish to do with them, if that makes any sense.
It certainly does. Nick, stay with us. This is Nick Doherty, who's the author of the British Firearms Handbook. Now, we were lucky enough to be invited up to a clay shooting ground, which is the Lee Valley Shooting Association in Hartford. Audio Boo's own Dolores William spoke to the club secretary, Alex Mitchell, to ask the sorts of people that visit the ground.
Well, we get Catholic saints.
Called Dolores.
We get blind people. We get kids as young as about 11. The lower age limit is nothing to do with their age, it's only their size. They need to be big enough so that they're not frightened when the gun goes off. We have people in wheelchairs shoot.
Alex, the only people I know that shoot guns are the characters in Made in Chelsea.
The Chelsea Bun and Shotgun Club coming here next month, and they are ladies that shoot, and they are ladies that eat cake. We've done gender, we've done age, and disability. We haven't done class yet. There are shooting environments which are very top-end. That's usually game shooting, people who go and shoot pheasant and partridge and grouse and that sort of thing. It's not to say that it's exclusively for them, but it's because it costs so much money that it tends to be that end of the social spectrum. But at a clay shooting ground, it's your builders, decorators, plasterers, painters, doctors.
And is it predominantly male?
Unfortunately, it is. And the ladies who come and shoot here feel that they've got to be good to do it. Whereas a bloke can turn up here and just shoot holes in the sky all day long and not be the slightest bit concerned, if a lady comes along, she will want to feel that she was good at doing it.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo. Sign up for your free account now.
And you can sign up for that free account at audioboo.fm. You can listen to us at hearhearshow.co.uk on the old interweb and on Twitter at hearhearshow as well. Still in studio is the social policy specialist Michael Storey. On the line with us is Nick Doherty, the author of the British Firearms Handbook, criminal barrister. Guys, listening to that, I mean, one of the issues Delora's raised is that she wonders whether shooting might be a little bit elitist. Now, you both shoot, don't you?
Yes.
Yes, we do, yeah.
You've obviously, Michael, applied for your shotgun certificate, and Nick likewise, but you deal with people who have difficulties. Michael, what's the process like for you? How did you find it?
Well, I found it fairly straightforward. I got involved in shotgun shooting. I decided that's what I wanted to go for. I got serious enough about it that I wanted to have my own gun, and so I sent in my application. It's a fairly straightforward process. It's £50, and you fill in a form which sets out your reasons for wanting to have a gun. And then there's also this medical component, which for me was a little bit complicated because I had some treatment for phobias, which obviously is flagged up on the mental health system.
Are you happy to discuss what the phobias are?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'm terrified of enclosed spaces, so I don't go on the tube and I won't go on an aeroplane.
Interesting.
And the treatment didn't work. So,
Nick Doherty, you deal with cases where people have applied, they refuse and you have to appeal. Do you get an awful lot of certificates rejected, either because someone has a history of mental health issues or depression?
There have been, in my experience, there's been an increase in the number of applicants who have had much more of an inquiry into their mental situation, particularly if they've disclosed that they've suffered from depression. I think that the police are tightening up on this. Can I just go back, though, to something that your guest in the studio said about how easy it is to get the ease of application? That's true. It's fairly straightforward. I think one thing that we need to bear in mind is that to apply for a firearm or shotgun certificate, it's the only circumstances in the UK where a police officer or a police employee will actually have to visit your home and effectively check out your home circumstances and you to see that what you've put on the form is correct. So although the procedure can be said to be fairly straightforward, it's actually more difficult to get a shooting certificate than it is to get a passport.
How do you feel the police are resourced at the moment with cuts and the like there? I mean, obviously any firearms licensing officer will privately discuss with people the notion that they just don't have the resources to chase up the inquiries they need to, at least as quickly as they can.
Well, they're massively under-resourced. There's no doubt about that, and I don't think that the police would try and say otherwise. They need more resources to do the job properly. There's no doubt about that.
OK, where can people get hold of the British Firearms Handbook, Nick Doherty?
British Firearms Law Handbook is available on Amazon. Or from the publishers, I think, Sweet and Maxwell.
Nick, thank you very much for joining us. Michael, stay with us. What we're going to do now is take a listen to maybe some of the public opinion, which is, I would say, mixed. It's not. Anecdotally on the street, people generally seem to be maybe a little sceptical on guns. So Daniel Richards has been out for Audio Boo to ask the public what they think about guns.
They can kill you. They're just dangerous.
That's what they're made for, realistically. They're not made for anything else apart from to shoot people, do you see what I'm saying, which is wrong.
You know, some people have guns and they use guns for sport.
No, I don't agree with that either.
I don't agree with that neither. Realistically, I think regardless of what you're going to use a gun for, you shouldn't really have a gun. Guns should not be allowed to anybody, regardless of what it is, apart from the police.
If you're in an area with loads of people that know how to use them, then it can be safe.
People can change. Say, for instance, you got your license today. 2 years' time, anything could happen. Something could trigger off, like your wife or whatever, and that's when the thing is there and they think it's time to start using it. Because that's what I would do. I'm not going to lie to you.
To be honest, you can get a gun so easily now. I mean, we know two people are in prison now because they've committed a triple murder because they shot people.
Yeah.
Get rid of it all, abolish it all.
Everyone is scared of guns, isn't it? They take lives, isn't it? I think no one should have license for a gun, you know, because we don't live in a war zone, isn't it? This is a peaceful community and peaceful neighbourhoods, and it's a peaceful country. So I don't think people need to have a gun to protect themselves, you know.
As long as proper checks done on their backgrounds, there's no problem.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Don't forget, a little later we'll hear how Audio Boo producer Dolores got on with her shooting lesson at the playground, the Lee Valley Shooting Association in Hartford. Michael Story, it's a fair point. We live in a peaceful society. Why do you want a shotgun in your house?
Well, we do live in a peaceful society, and I think shooting can be part of that. There in London, there are 66,000 people with shotgun certificates and both kinds of firearm certificates within the M25. Mm. And by and large, London's a very peaceable place.
A very peaceable place?
Extremely, by comparison to other world cities. London's one of the safest places you can live.
Unless you happen to be there during the riots.
Well, that's true. But I think the riots is a really useful jumping-off point to look at the role of guns in London's security. I mean, there are these 66,000 people who have a gun, and during the riots, there were no shootings. There was one guy who was shot over the whole period of a week, which is actually slightly less than you'd expect over a week in London.
See, one of the other issues, and we'll speak shortly with Peter Squires on this, but I know an area of your interest is illegal firearms, because we've focused rather a lot on certificate holders at the moment. It can't be denied. There have been serious cases where certificate holders have done bad things, and I do accept that it is a very tiny percentage of certificate holders. But in and around London, the amount of gun crime, and it's true of places like Manchester as well and Birmingham, it is huge. It is colossal. 44% of all gun crime in 2011 was used, or the subject of handgun misuse. Now, they were outlawed in 1997. So to what extent is certification an issue versus illegal guns and the importation?
There's a canyon between those two issues. A lot of the handgun violence that you see in London, it's not people that have had guns since they were banned after the Dunblane. These are coming in from Eastern Europe. It's ex-Soviet weapons.
Converted firers.
Yes, indeed, converted.
And replicas.
Veterinary.
And it's worth pointing out that any firearm where it's lawful to use them, they have what's called proofing, so they can withstand certain form of ballistics. In the UK, we have many more shootings than we do fatalities in London, because also the ammunition is hard to get. But isn't it a shocking state if, you know, we've got all these firearms laws, but when these people are getting hold of guns anyway?
The fact that people are getting hold of these weapons illegally, it's almost never traced back to certificate holders or to the firearm licensing system. Now, that's not the case in the United States. In the United States, there are lots and lots of problems of people buying guns legally and then supplying them to criminals. That doesn't
happen
here.
It's hard to tell in the States, of course, because the transfer of weapons can happen at gun fairs without any ID needing to be shown. But we'll come back on these issues in a very short while. Let's bring in Peter Squires, who's Professor of Criminology at the University of Brighton, spokesman for the Gun Control Network. Peter, this is always going to be a controversial issue. Is it realistic to say that we can ever ban guns altogether from the UK?
Well, no, clearly not. I mean, whenever we have a military and a police force, then we can't ban guns. We can't uninvent them. And there will always be criminals trying to bring them in, organised criminals, and there will always be, I think, an illegal market for them. Anything you ban is, in a sense, it hikes the price for criminal entrepreneurs who see an opportunity to make money out of people's demand for illegal
contraband. I think the problem is you speak to people like Michael Story and indeed a mutual contact of us all, Michael Yardley, and they'll say that actually restrictions only affect the law-abiding because they say that criminals will just ignore any legislation. What's your take on that?
Gun laws will affect the law-abiding because the law-abiding, on the whole, tend to follow them. But I don't think there's an absolute airtight category of law-abiding and illegal. There's slippage between the two, and that has been one of the problems. Virtually all guns start out as legal, and somewhere from the point of production to the point of use, they slip from legal holders, legal manufacturers, legal transporters, or legal shooters. They slip into
illegal hands. So let's be clear about
that.
Do they slip from being legal in the UK to being illegal in the UK, or do they slip from being illegal somewhere in the world?
if you go back to the 90s, in the period before Dunblane, there were a number of high-profile prosecutions of licensed gun dealers in Britain who were responsible for fraudulent paperwork that entailed them selling firearms to criminals. There were also a number of importers of deactivated weapons who were purchasing these weapons essentially as military souvenirs.
This was before the days that the proof houses actually here in the United Kingdom had to deactivate it by destroying various mechanisms. It used to be very shoddy deactivations.
This is true, but I don't think the problem has ever gone away, because there is still a market for reactivatable deactivated weapons, and we know now that something like a fifth to a quarter of all criminally used handguns on the streets of Britain come in as non-firing or CF gas firing weapons, or Olympic starting pistols, for instance, and then they're re-engineered.
That's a good example. The Olympic firearms starting pistol that you mentioned was recently reclassified following firearms review because it was, as the legislation says, easily convertible. It's right, isn't it, that we're vigilant about this to stop criminals getting their hands on things that are readily convertible?
Of course, and that was part of the role of the new firearms control framework and the role of NABIS, which is the Police National Ballistics Intelligence Service. They were tracking the various import and crime involvement profiles of a number of guns, Baikals, Eastern European guns, the Bruno, and then up pops the Olympic 380, something like 179 of these converted weapons on the streets of London. They hit a marker in NABIS, and NABIS then undertakes an investigation into their criminal misuse.
You know, just broadly speaking, would you say the problem with firearms in the UK is predominantly with legally owned firearms or with criminal owners of firearms?
Well, it's fairly clear to me that the overwhelming problem of firearm crime in Britain is illegal weapons in the hands of committed and often career offenders or young gang members. But I still think, you know, if you look at the data and what we know about misuse of licensed firearms, around 15% of gun crime is attributable to licensed weapons
that have fallen into the wrong hands.
And we can't ignore that. Often that is a problem of domestic violence. Someone who's maybe owned a shotgun for a long time and in the end turns it upon his partner and himself. And there have been a few high-profile incidents of that.
Including Durham, and I believe there's research in Canada to say that domestic violence and firearms poses an incredible risk, and it's one where there's a balance, I suppose, between public safety. I'm going to put it to you because the mere suggestion of domestic violence will absolutely, there is no doubt, stop any police chief from issuing anybody with a firearms or shotgun certificate, regardless of whether there has or hasn't been any evidence of that.
I think there has to be evidence. I think there has to be some sort of evidence background check to ensure that the person who has the firearm has a clean bill of health. We know that the Canadian registry has made a significant impact on domestic violence.
Is this where you need to get a signature from your current or most recent spouse to get?
Yes.
Or there's extra background checks if they refuse to sign it, of course.
Yes.
All right, well, just briefly run over the gun control networks and your personal view on what's wrong with the current system. How can we tighten it, maybe close up some of those loopholes to stop another Derek Bird or Michael Atherton?
We don't have a simple party line. So, for instance, in the wake of Derek Bird, I went on quite a few TV and radio interviews arguing about people stockpiling large quantities of ammunition in their own home. I know there is a demand on the part of shooters to keep their weapons at home, but it seems to me if their only involvement in shooting is at organised shooting events, then they don't need the ammunition permanently available to them in their homes where it's the most vulnerable for misuse.
Let's ask Michael Storey. He's with us. He's a shotgun certificate holder himself and a social policy commentator. Why do you need to buy shotgun ammunition, for instance, in batches of 500 or even 1,000?
Well, the biggest one is price. There is a big, big saving in buying ammunition by the thousand.
How much does it cost you for 1,000 cartridges?
1,000 cartridges at for competition level, getting on for £200.
Right, OK. So is that not fair point, Peter, economy of scale?
No, not balanced to my mind, with public safety. It seems to me if the shoot is organised, then the provision of the ammunition at the shoot should be equally organised. I don't think the convenience of shooters is necessarily my uppermost priority compared with public safety.
Well, come on, that's a fair point, isn't it, Michael Story? The idea of public safety versus your convenience?
Well, I think these things have to be put in balance. I mean, our shooting team at the London School of Economics, we win things, and we win things by training regularly, and we easily blast through 500 to 1,000 cartridges a month each. I mean, there's a lot of ammunition there. You're talking about quite a significant amount of infrastructure needed to support that type of ammunition.
Yeah, sure, but wouldn't it be fair to say, well, do you really need to store your ammunition at home?
There have been arguments saying that it should be stored in shooting clubs or sort of central.
And your
places.
View on that?
Well, I think it depends where you live. If you live in somewhere like London, where you're always near a firearms dealer, there's plenty of places you could do that. But if you're out in the middle of the country, it does seem like a bit of if you're a farmer and you want to go out and you've got a problem with, you know, foxes coming in or something, you want to.
You're not going to need to kill 1,000 foxes in the morning, I put it to you.
Well, but then the argument here is, should you be allowed to have any ammunition? I mean, what's a suitable amount?
I don't have the same problem at all with people whose work, professional game controllers or pest controllers or farmers, having a limited quantity of ammunition for their daily working needs. My concern is sports shooters who shoot in organised sporting events. I mean, how many rabbits, as you say, do you need to shoot any given morning? I think that's a bit of a red herring.
Well, issue. I guess it depends if you're a gamekeeper, because you're saying that's part of the job.
Yes, and I don't have a problem with, I that's a job, and the ammunition would come with the job. I'd still have concern about quantity, but I would concede the principle, as indeed Michael has conceded the essence of the principle in relation to sport shooting.
You've obviously looked in before to the differences in, and I'm looking at some shotgun prices online as we speak. So just cartridges I've got in front of me, it's a place where shotgun shooters shoot. You can get 1,000 here from about 170, or you can buy from another supplier here in Letchworth and Hertfordshire, for example, £8.50 for a packet of 25. That it's a huge financial, effectively punitive financial cost for the sake of changing regulations. No,
I'm not particularly convinced. Have you looked at the price of some shotguns? I mean, they run to the thousands. If people are participating in an elite sport with high caliber equipment, they need to spend money on it, and therefore I think I would extend that to the ammunition. At the moment, I mean, there are currently proposals to change the burden of cost for the licensing fee, that it should be self-financing. At the moment, the taxpayer is subsidising the licensing arrangements to the tune of some £200 per application. So I think if we're talking costs, I think the cost of the licence should fall on those who want to participate in the sport.
And it wouldn't penalise poorer people?
I'm sure it would, but that would be part of a choice they make about their sporting participation.
Michael?
Part of the issue there is that there's a lot of cost. There's a bit of an element with the shotgun licence already being £50, it only lasts for 5 years. Barrel proofing is very expensive. That's why we don't have cheap guns in this country, and that's for safety reasons, which I do agree with. But it does mean that the entry price for shotgun will often be over £1,000.
All right, look, last word then to Peter Squires, who's Professor of Criminology, spokesman for the Gun Control Network. Your response to that, and last word goes to you, sir.
I don't think necessarily it's down to the taxpayer to subsidise shooting.
Hear, hear, with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Very big thank you there to Peter Squires, a Professor of Criminology from the University of Brighton, spokesman as well for the Gun Control Network. Michael Story, the social policy commentator in studio with us. We'll be back with you in a second, Michael. But I want to find out how our producer, who's never shot a gun before, by the way, Dolores William, got on when she went to the Lee Valley Shooting Association in Hertford. Let's take a listen to her lesson with senior instructor Tim Tilley.
I want you to stand with your feet about 9 inches apart. Right hand comes and controls this part of the gun here, which is a pistol grip.
Yeah.
Good habit to get into. See my finger?
Yes.
Wood is good.
Wood is good.
It's a very simple, silly saying, but it's great, because keep your finger off the trigger till you're comfortable and ready to call
wood
for your target.
Wood is good.
Shall we try it for real?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pull.
Up.
Wow.
Okay. That was a good try.
Man, quick.
We can improve on that. Yes?
Yeah.
Not a bad effort.
Thank
this
you.
This time, I want you to track the target a bit more.
Right.
That was a little bit quick.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, and that's okay, but I want you to track the target, nice and relaxed, and shoot straight at it.
Pull!
Shoot. Yeah!
Yes!
Fantastic!
Done it!
Oh, that's fabulous. That's really exciting.
It's a great sport. It's not a physical sport. It's a skill sport. And women can do just as well as fellas at it.
Yeah, that was really good.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
I don't know, Dolores with a gun, it scares me, I can't lie. But Michael Storey, still with us, the social policy commentator, shotgun certificate holder yourself. Now, Dolores and I are still having this kind of ongoing dialogue, this discussion as to whether shooting is an elite sport. And she's got a point that it's relatively elite in parts.
It depends what you mean by elite. I mean, I think there is a perception, certainly, that shooting is something that's just for posh people. And really, my experience is that isn't true. If you go to any shooting ground, you'll find a whole range of people involved in it. Obviously, there tend to be a media image of things which differs from that. But that's one of the problems of these type of distortions that affect a lot of sports. But I think elite in the sense of being good at it, that's a different thing. Britain is very, very good at shooting. We've won medals at all the most recent Olympics. We've got top shoes like Richard Folds. Pete Wilson got a gold medal in the London Olympics. We are very, very good at this, not just in the Olympics, but in the Shooting World Cup. And we're doing very, very well.
If you've got a comment on that, we have a channel here on Audio Boo. It's Have I Got Boos For You. You can find that through the app on your iPhone, your iPad, your Android, any sort of device you've got. Audio Boo exists there, including the internet. Or you can check out the show site and involve yourself directly there. And that's at hearhearshow.com. UK. Now, one thing we haven't really touched on fully, you mentioned earlier that you've had mental health issues, specifically in terms of phobias. Do we get that right? Because anecdotally, police officers tell me that people can even be sectioned who hold certificates, and it's virtually impossible, certainly as of recently, I would guess it might have changed, to revoke that certificate.
Well, that does sound a little bit alarming, but I think generally the perception of mental health problems is changing. Mental health screening is getting that much better all the time. So somebody like me who was claustrophobic in some way, you know, that's not the sort of thing that you would have gone to your GP about 40 years ago.
I'm surprised that even counts as a mental health issue, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, if you go and see a psychiatrist about something, you've got a mental illness, and that's what goes on your medical record. And so you do need to declare that.
So obviously, I've got in front of me, it's Form 103. It says if you've got, it asks if you've got a history of depression or mental illness. It also asks about alcohol, drugs and epilepsy. What did you write in that box?
I put yes, and I put my GP's details. And I did explain what was going on, but it was to do with phobias and so on. But when I had my interview, when the firearms officer came to my house, I mean, he basically said, "You're not going to shoot anybody, are you?" And I said, "No." He said, "There's a good chap." But
I hope it was more rigorous than that. You're not going to shoot him, are you? No. No, I mean, it's, you know, I think many people listening, though, will be slightly surprised when you hear that sort of thing. But actually, what he's probably looking out for is your facial expressions.
Yes, of course. Such. Yeah.
That's what those interviews are supposed to be about, as I understand it, is just sussing the person.
Absolutely. But I think one of the problems of this mental health focus is that if you have someone who already has a shotgun certificate, there is a tremendous anxiety about stigma and problems and so on. You've got to be very careful about eroding trust in people's relationship with their GP.
But I mean, it's an interesting point. Say, for instance, you felt sort of down or depressed. You've got a shotgun certificate. Would it make any difference as to whether you would go and speak to your GP about that, do you feel?
Yes, I think it might well do. And I know people in this position who have said exactly that they've felt anxious about approaching their GP because they're not sure whether they're going to, the first thing that's going to happen is they're going to lose access to their weapons. People need to feel that there's a trust there. You can see why that would make people anxious.
Well, I think the British Medical Association's opinion on this issue is a very difficult one. And we'd love to have heard them representing this view, but unfortunately, you know, I don't know what's gone on there down in the press office. I think what they're saying is the notion of potentially tagging medical records to say that someone's got a certificate. As promised, a polarising issue here on the Hear Hear show. Polarising issue, as if. So where do you get the right balance between public safety and individual freedom? Is that even the debate that we're having? Do leave a comment in the Have I Got Boos For You channel. Check us out on audioboo.fm, where you can sign up for your free account. Next week, we'll be discussing extremism here in the UK. My name's been Sean Dilley. This has been Hear Hear, exclusively for Audio Boo.
Hear Hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.